Smooth is overrated because I think when we begin, we have this idea of perfection. And what, as the longer that you're in the field, you realize what we kind of yearn for is the handmade cup, you know, like the handmade cup with the imperfections that you can't buy a 100-piece set that looks all the same. You want something that has that feel of the human hand.
I'm Bob Acton, and I'm pleased to introduce Michelle Gregor to you today. I love Michelle's work and her use of color to enhance her sculptural pieces. She is one of the world's top sculptors, and I'm so happy to have her here today to share a conversation with you. As I mentioned, she is considered a leading figure in the second generation of Bay Area figuration out of California, USA. She is a multifaceted artist who works in clay, bronze, paint, and drawing media, handling each medium with a process-oriented and intuitive approach that results in painterly forms and images. She has a masterful, intuitive sense of color that unifies her productions in various media, and she engages all of her work with a painterly vigor that reflects her Bay Area roots and also her deep understanding of abstract expressionism. So let's get to the show, and you can find all of the links to access Michelle in the show notes.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Color and Ceramics podcast. I am super excited about having you here today. You know, I love your sculptures and your use of color and surface design, and I'm crazy about your oranges and blues and reds you use. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here, and thank you for the opportunity to talk with you.
Absolutely. This will be great. I think our folks will love your work if they're not familiar with you already, and get a chance to understand how you think about color and surface design. You know, obviously your work has taken years for you to develop your style and your techniques and so on. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey in clay and kind of what got you here today?
Sure. I think I really fell in love with clay when I was an undergraduate at University of California at Santa Barbara. And I always thought that I was going to be a writer because I love to read. But when I went into college, I went in sort of the golden age in education, especially in California with the UC system. It was so different back then. And I just took all these things that I thought maybe I would be interested in. And printmaking, ceramics. And when I found ceramics, I think it was the studio environment that really grabbed me. And the community, I think it was really the community of people that I really felt like I found my place. And so that's where I started out. And I started out on the potter's wheel and just got I got really hooked on learning how to make shapes in space. And back in the time, this was like in the early 80s, we had about 5 buckets of glaze. And there were all the standard glazes that we all recognize, the Temaku, the Celadon, you know, and a handful of others. Like literally there were 5 buckets of glaze and a couple of pots on the counter with some, you know, cobalt oxide, some copper carbonate, and to do some decorating with. And that was it. And that was my foundation. And I just kind of worked my way through various studios and found my kind of my voice. I think I started doing sculpture when I went to graduate school at San Francisco State. And one of my professors, David Kuroka, who was a thrower, he told me, he said, you need to let go of the vessel, because I started sculpting all these figures onto the vessel, and the figures were really taking over the vessel. And he said, I think maybe you should try letting go of the vessel. And that pushed me into just making sculpture. As far as being a colorist, I think that was just sort of an organic, is the way it just sort of unfolded. And materials have gotten so much better throughout the years. Like now we have a candy, so it's like being a kid in the candy store. You can go into the ceramic supply and there's just everything. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And then I started teaching, and now I teach at a city college. So I actually never got out of the studio. Once I stepped in, I never got out.
Yeah, it's funny how people get hooked with clay, isn't it? It's
Oh.
addictive, I think. A healthy addiction, of course, but certainly one that once you get touched, and I don't know how many people I've spoken to on this podcast and in other parts of my world, and they'll say, "Oh yeah, I got into clay and I just never got out."
Right.
Funny about that, eh? I wonder what it is. Do you think it's the I haven't thought this through at all, but as we're talking, all of a sudden it seems to me maybe it's that tactile nature of clay. It's getting our hands into the muck and the clay itself. I wonder if that's a component.
I think it is. And that was the first word that came up when you were asking, what do you think it is? And tactile was the first thing that came to my mind. And I think that that's it. It's like you put an impression in, and there it is. And there's something that's, I think, connects us to our childhood experience of, playing out and, making things out of nothing. That really appealed to me too. But definitely, there is an aspect of the community which also is plays a big part in why I fell in love with clay, because I have found that anywhere I go in this world, if I can find a studio with people who work in clay, I find my people. And I think that we are just a certain type of person that we're, maybe it's that tactile nature, but I always love clay studios and I always love clay communities and clay people. So.
That's great. That is awesome. Hey, I'm really interested in what inspires people. And I know these days, things like Instagram can pull our attention away from the studio or away from our central work in many ways, because we can spend not only time looking at all of those images, but start to go, oh, maybe I should be doing that, or I best be doing this. And so I'm interested in what inspires you. Like what's at the root of many of your pieces these days?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm inspired by so many different things. And I think that my focus or my inspiration changes all the time, even from day to day and from minute to minute. But I think on a grand scale, my work is really inspired by a sort of a sense of improvisation. Like, I really like to see what the material will give me, and then I can react to the material. And then put it into the kiln and get it back. So there's that sort of give and take with the material. So the material itself is really central to my inspiration, because it always surprises me. No matter how many times I test colors or slips or stains or whatever, and I open up the kiln and I'm constantly surprised, and not always happily surprised. But the clay, it just like as you work, as the longer that you work in clay, you realize that the material itself has so many variations, like from the soft nature of clay, and then as it stiffens up and as it holds its form or as it starts to slump and all that, just the material itself is super inspiring to me, and that tactile quality that you mentioned before. I also am a big museum goer. Like, I love looking at art, and Instagram is one of those things where I can spend way too much time on. I just love like filling my head with images. I'm not one of those people who cuts myself off from looking at images because I think I'm gonna be influenced. Like, that does not concern me. Is the more the better. I just love seeing what people are doing. I love looking at painters, sculptors. textile artists. I mean, the world is so filled with so many different art forms, and now they're at our fingertips. So definitely, I'm inspired by social media. And then, of course, the great inspiration for so many of us, nature. And nature is an unending source of inspiration. And I live in California, Northern California. I commute to work. I commute along a really beautiful Highway 280 that goes between San Francisco and San Jose. And it goes along the coast, and it is just breathtaking. I commute to work 2 days a week down to San Jose City College, where I teach. And the commute takes me about 50 minutes. And every single day, I'm just surprised at how beautiful it is and what the trees look like and how the trees change. We have these beautiful oak trees that, they just like change all throughout the year. And it's an unending fascination, nature, and just being out in nature. So that's a big one for me too. I bet you it's the same for you up there in Canada.
Absolutely. I love nature. I call it being out in the bush. And maybe that's sort of where I came from. But absolutely. And lots of things that inspire me are the animals and the insects and those kinds of things. And I worry about biodiversity these days and that we are ruining our environment. And so that's kind of a thing that catches me. Hey, boy, you talked about a lot of different things there when you talked about inspiration, and this may seem like a crazy thought, but when you were talking, I was thinking that really your notion that the clay speaks to you really is the clay, I guess, at some level used to be alive. Right. It was
Absolutely.
something in the earth, whether it's the flora or the fauna, and it ended up in the soil and down into clay. And in a way, it's maybe alive again in our hands as it begins to speak to us. Because that is true, isn't it? We really do have to manage our relationship with the piece.
I love that. I love thinking about that. And it's funny that you say that it is alive, especially when we take it and it's fresh and it's filled with water and living organisms and it's pliable, plastic. We can mold it, we can change it. And then as it goes into the kiln, it becomes like stone, becomes so hard. And I often think about things like trees or like stones, and I think about them, how they are there and they witness the passing of human beings, like big trees that are there for hundreds of years or even longer than that. And they see generations of people going by them, or even stones. Like, we don't know what the vitality is within a stone. We really have no idea. And that's what we're doing with clay, right? We're putting it into the kiln and it metamorphosizes into this other object that has our fingerprints and our actions put upon it. And that will also outlive all of us, at least in its shard form.
Yeah, totally. I was in Turkey recently and walking through many
Beautiful.
of the Roman ruins and Greek ruins and so on. And of course, realizing I'd done a little bit of research on the history of the peoples, and many of the ceramic pieces there that are available are thousands of years old, right? I mean, it's really interesting. And
Interesting.
so I think that there's a link back. Like, I had a bust I made sitting on my deck this week, and we had a big windstorm come through, and it got knocked off the deck and smashed on the floor. And I,
Oh.
well, that's okay. I can make another one. But I thought about it really in the context of what we're talking about, that the pieces that will end up back in the soil, because I can't put this one back together again, will kind of eventually end up back in clay, and somebody thousands of years from now might be regenerating those pieces again.
That's
Yeah.
right. Or
Yeah.
somebody might pick up a little shard with, a little bit of texture on it and wonder where that comes from,
Yeah. Yeah.
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, another idea that you had was that it's important for you to experiment in a way. I guess that's not the word you used, but you were saying, well, I try this out, and then what comes out of the kiln can be a surprise, sometimes pleasant, sometimes not. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about an emerging artist Because I think I used to when I was starting off, and I think many others do think that we should have complete control over what we're doing, right? And that it should come out of the kiln just like I thought it should every time I do it, because I've tested lots and kept very good notes on my tests and everything. What do you think about it? Have you got any thoughts for some more, I'll call them junior folks?
Well, I think that it makes me kind of smile because I teach a lot of students every year. I teach at a city college. I've been there for over 20 years. I've seen a lot of students come through my classroom, through my studio. And one of the questions that I often get la asked is, how do I make this smooth? How do I make this smooth? And I always answer is, if you don't make it smooth, you're going to give the opportunity for the glazes or the slips or the stains to actually have something to attach to and get some really interesting marks. And sort of smooth is overrated. So that's one of the catchphrases I'll say is smooth is overrated. Because I think when we begin, we have this idea of perfection. And what as the longer that you're in the field, you realize what we kind of yearn for is the handmade cup, like the handmade cup with the imperfections that you can't buy a 100-piece set that looks all the same. You want something that's has that feel of the human hand. So I encourage folks to open up to seeing the imperfections. And we go to the museum. There's a lovely museum near my campus at the Stanford University has a wonderful small museum, the Cantor, and they have a collection of beautiful ceramics from all around the world. And I just delight in bringing my students there because we look into some of the pots and there'll be like a little crumb of something that got stuck in the glaze, or you'll see where there might be a tiny crack on the edge. And I said, look, those are sitting in museums. They're from, some of them are from 500 years ago, 700 years ago. And look at that. There's the imperfection. And you see those imperfections come out of the kiln. I call them like a beauty spot or something when you get like a little, sometimes, the clay, it'll spit out a little piece of iron or something and they'll say, whoa, it's ruined. No, it's not. It's just like that's something that came out of the clay that you didn't intend. And for me, that's something to celebrate.
Yeah, that's that relationship back and forth. Now, you are doing sculptures these days, mostly of the human form, right? And can you talk a little bit about how you approach this notion of the form versus the surface? Because we can talk about color and surface design, and we will for sure, but also it's does relate to the form. And I'd like you to tell us how you think about that.
The relationship of form to surface. These are great questions, Bob. I'm thinking about the I oh, I often another thing I often tell my students is that ceramics is one of the greatest art forms because we really have both form and surface. Painters, they have the surface. A lot of bronze sculptors, sure, they have patina, but we as ceramists, like we really have form and surface to the max. We can really dig deep into either one of those areas. When I work on forms, I like to keep some what I call wild areas. So areas that are rough, areas that are like torn pieces of clay, areas that are like kind of just let the clay be the clay and sort of look for those beautiful. The beautiful manifestations of sort of tearing or drooping or, things that I don't have control over. And those areas really accept the glazes and the colors so nicely. And there's also a sort of a preciousness when I find when I sculpt something, if I work really hard on it and, make it look just so, I become almost too precious with it. And I don't allow myself the freedom. So when I begin to work on the surfaces of my sculptures, I usually start with the sculpture that I like the least in the group. Like I'll work on a bunch of pieces all at once. Like I'll have a bunch of stuff going all at once. And I'll tend to do all my sculpting. And then once I get the sculpting done, I'll put away all the sculpture materials and I'll pull out all the glazes and stains, etc. And then I'll always pick my least favorite sculpture to start with so that I can be free with it. And those always turn out to be the best ones. Because
Because you're free.
I'm free.
Yeah. Like when you said it's precious, that made me think that that's when we assign that preciousness to a piece, that's when we become tight, is the word I would use, right? The lines become tight, my fingers are tight, and I
You don't
can't have
want
this.
to ruin
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That's really interesting that you say that. Now, how do you approach color, because you use some fantastic, lovely colors. Oh, let's talk about just surface design for the moment. Like, how do you think about that? How do you approach it? You know, way back when you were talking about having the five buckets, and in the days of when we were throwing, I'm doing mostly sculpture stuff now myself, is I was taught you dip it in, and maybe you dip it in twice, depending on how thick it was, and then you're done, right? So tell us a little bit about that.
Color for me is it remains one of the great mysteries, and I never seem to know as much as I need to know. And on any given day, I have a different approach. I don't have a standard approach. So like I say, I look at a lot of paintings. I look at paintings and I look at color. I call them color stories that seem to work together. And I'll look at that and I'll think like, wow, interesting. Like Diebenkorn, for example. I love looking at Richard Diebenkorn's paintings, and I'll look at them and I'll think like, wow, he's got all these colors that overlay other colors, and then there'll be like a bright slash of some other color. And I'll sort of let those things influence me. I'll just fill my head with looking at paintings. And then I'll sort of drag myself into the studio. And first thing I like to do is I like to open up all of the containers so that I can see what I have. And then I pull out I usually use a palette. So I usually use like a bat from the wheel, those plastic bats, the black one. And I'll use those for a palette. And I'll treat it just like a painter's palette. So I'll just put like little dots of color. We usually stay. Grab maybe four or five colors that I'm sort of feeling that day and start with those and mix them. By the end of the day, it's mayhem in there. It looks like total chaos. And I often wash things off. I'll try something. If I don't like it, I'll wash it off. But of course, these are all different stages of the clay, right? Usually before I put the form into the kiln for the first time, the figure, I'll put a white slip on it, a porcelain slip. So I'll tend to use a sculpture body and then like a groggy sculpture body to build with. And oftentimes a buff color, sometimes terracotta, but oftentimes like a buff sculpture body. And then I'll make some porcelain slip and just slap porcelain slip on so that I have some subtle variation right in the beginning. And depending on what brushes I use, those will leave marks onto the clay. And that will go get put into the kiln. When it comes out of the bisque, I already have some, pretty delicate variation going on. And then I put on colors pretty thin. I use a lot of water. And when you put colors on the bisque, it's so exciting because you can just get these most beautiful marks, but you have to pay attention. So I'll put a lot of water into my brush and maybe choose typically a darker color to pick up those first marks and saturate the brush and let the water drip down and sort of see what's going to happen, and all of those marks will grab onto the color in the most exciting way. But you only get one go at that because that clay is porous. So I find at that point, I have to be really, really attentive to what's happening. I have to really look and see, is that mark something that I like, that, and can I keep it? And then if I do want to keep that mark, I have to be careful, not to put water over it, how to stabilize it so that I can keep that beautiful drip or that beautiful, slide of color, and kind of go from there. So it's literally like it's a new journey every time. I feel like it is literally unfolding every time, brand new.
I hear you. You're really alive when you're doing that. And you've got a very interesting way with your attention, it seems like. Like you have this very wide open attention in the beginning by taking attention to other people's work, painters, the oak trees as you're driving down the road, all of those things. And then it gradually gets more and more focused until you're in the studio with the brush in your hand. And then all of a sudden you have to be hyper-focused. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's a really nice recap. It's a splendid way of recapping that story. It's so true. And I found different, I still do a lot of multi-firing. So I'll put the piece in and sort of, get it to stabilize and then bring it back out. And I found recently, and I can't believe that it took me this long to figure it out, but I've been using, like a workable fixative. So I found that I can actually use a workable fixative like you would use with charcoal drawing, and that will also fix those marks. So it'll allow me to go a little bit deeper in before I have to put it in the kiln, So yeah, but that attention, what you're talking about, that paying attention, yeah, especially when it comes to the surface, you really have to zone in, and you have to sort of allow the marks to do their thing, and then decide, is that something that I want to see? And then sometimes I'll take a sponge and I'll wipe it away, and then because of the porosity of the bisque, it leaves its own kind of mark. But there's one, I always think, like there's one go at it at that fresh bisque state. And a lot of people describe that state as sort of like the dead state, right? When the piece comes out of the kiln in the bisque and we look at it, we're like, oh. But there, that's also to me a very exciting state, is that it's like a raw canvas.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can do multiple firings, right? So you can add, take off, sandblast. You could do whatever you wanted, really, I suppose, to the piece at that point in time. So let's just stick on this attention thing for a minute, because I think that's really interesting. I was a psychologist in my work life, and I've taken on this ceramics as I gave that up and start to do this full time. And so I'm interested in attention because I think that's a really key thing we all talk about these days. We can get distracted easily. Are there things that you do in your studio that help you stay focused, or things that help you avoid the distractions outside of you?
I think similar to a lot of people I've talked to is listen to music. I listen to books on tape, and honestly, I don't even hear what they're saying. Like I'll listen to the same book 5 times. It's just having the noise of a human being like speaking in the room. I don't know what it is. It's a mystery to me, but it kind of calms me down and centers me. Have you heard that before, other artists saying that?
Yeah, for sure,
I
for
wonder
sure.
if, as a psychologist, does that have any, can you make sense of that?
Yeah, for sure. I think lots of times the creative space that we get into is when we get into a zone where we're not thinking about things, as opposed to being very thoughtful and problem solving, which is another whole skill set we need. But sometimes if we're in the shower, that's when an idea will come to us. When we're just in that zone between being fully awake and being asleep. And so there's some good neuroscience behind that. And I think in a way the music helps us get to that state. It's kind of like the sound of the water running in the shower, right? That we are able to get into that space.
Interesting.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's good. So that's a really good tip for people. Now tell us a bit more about your color, because you use some very deep and brilliant colors, and I think in some ways they feel like a watercolor that you're using. You do use water. Are these glazes, underglazes, stains with a fixative or with a fret in it? Like, what do you do?
I really love stains, straight stains. So I have lots of stains in little jars and I love those. I definitely use a vehicle for those because some of them will come off. Some of them will stick on and some of them you'll fire them up and they'll just come right off. So they're all different little different animals that you kind of have to get to know. I use a medium that I get at the ceramic supply. It's called kaleidoscopic stain base. And I have no idea what's in it. If I don't have any of that, I'll usually use a little bit of colemanite. You know, I'll just take a, if I'm somewhere and I don't have my stain base, I'll just take some water and put a little bit of colemanite in there, just like a little tablespoon. I don't want to put too much in there because I don't want to turn it into a glaze, but that will usually fix a stain. It's just like water with a little bit of colemanite in it. I like the dry stains. I love the underglazes, the commercial underglazes, because they're so reliable now. You practically can get any color that you dream of, and I mix them. So I'll mix my underglazes with my stains, or underglazes with underglazes. Using that sort of palette, I'll have a palette and I'll mix colors. I love doing that. I had a printmaking professor when I was in college who it's sort of stuck inside my brain, and she said, "Never use black out of the can. Never use black out of the can." I was like, "Oh, okay. Never use black out of the can." So I sort of do that also with my underglazes. If I have black, I'll mix some blue into it or mix some orange into it, make a warm black, make a cool black. I love mixing the colors together and see what I'll get. Sometimes, like I mentioned before, I'll open up the kiln and it will be not ex something that I totally didn't expect, and sometimes bad, sometimes good. I also use the glaze pencils, which I love. But I'll typically start with underglazes and stains and do the first layer, a very thin layers. I like thin layers of color, and I like to build those layers up. Once I have a pretty good, my colors kind of laid in there, then I'll go in with glaze pencils and glaze those crayons, those glaze crayons, which I love. I've got those. My last move is the glaze. And I like a little bits of glaze, not too much glaze. I don't like the shine of the glaze too much, but I do like the contrast, a little bit of contrast with the shiny and the matte. But I try and not put on glazes until the very, very end because I've found that that's what will usually, once you put a glaze on, it's really hard to get it off. You've got to have a sandblaster. So that's kind of my last move.
And how do you select where the glaze goes? So is that where you want the eye to go? 'Cause I, or like, what's your thoughts around that?
You know, I've had such a journey with that. So I've always sort of resisted, you know, making something look like it should, like, you know, the girl wearing a dress and the dress should look like this and the hair should be this color. I've always really resisted that. But there are parts of the figure that I do like to, like the face. I like the eyes to be, you know, the color in the eyes or whatever color in the lips. But I like to keep kind of an open mind about coloring the figures. Like I don't like it to be too predictable, I guess.
Same with the glaze then. If you're adding that shine, you don't want it to be predictable either. And you might splash it on, given that live energetic process that you use, it is what comes to mind if in fact it comes to mind, it's some sort of unconscious process, it sounds like, for
Yes,
you when you're
I
applying
would
now.
say so. I would say so. I used to call it intuitive, and now I call it improvisational. It's like a improvisational music, a musician, is you're reacting to something that you see. And so it's not altogether intuitive, because there is a there definitely is an analytic part of it. Like, you think that I'll look and I'll think, like, well, it'd be nice to have some shine, but I don't want too much shine. And also, there's so many types of glazes, as you know, Bob. There's, satin glazes and shiny glazes and colored glazes, transparent glazes and matte glazes. So I tend to reach for transparent glazes, and also sort of soft, what do you call them? Those, satin glazes, like sort of soft glazes.
Now, so here you are at your stage of your career, and you're talking about being free and easy, and you're like a jazz player. You're like Miles Davis with
I
your
wish.
brushes. And now, if I take us back to somebody who might be listening, who's earlier on in their career, how would you advise them about learning the technical pieces? Because you've got a lot of technical skills. You said, I've got to learn this, and there's some analytical pieces to this. What's the best way for people to learn that technical piece so that you can be free when you're in the studio?
I think for someone who's just starting out, I think that, we're all going to come from different places, and there's going to be a lot of people who have an idea of what they want, and that's almost easier in a way, because you can say, if I want something that's very lifelike and realistic, and I want it to look like this, in some ways that's almost easier. Because then you can find people who you can study, like, how do you do this, and use, something that's worked, like a recipe almost. I think as artists, we're kind of trying to find ourselves, like we're trying to find our way into ourselves and really find out what makes us tick and what gives us joy. And for me, that sort of sense of freedom and discovery is really what brings me joy. I think it really depends on the personality of the young artist. But as far as understanding the material, I think that's key, is understanding what clay can do and what it can't do, or what, needs time to set up, or ways to build up a surface. It's really time and practice and putting in the time. And I think for people just starting out is, like, make a lot of things and do a lot of testing, and don't get too precious about things, because if you work for 100 hours on a beautiful sculpture and it comes out of the kiln, and inevitably it's going to have a crack, it's going to break your heart. Put in the kiln, you might put on the wrong glaze. You'll probably put on the wrong glaze. It'll break your heart again. And you spent 100 hours on it. Wouldn't it be better to have 10 pieces that you spent 10 hours on each, and maybe one of them is going to come out great? So I think that really putting in the time and doing more than just, like, everything is not a, does not need to be a masterpiece. We don't know Picasso. We don't know who Picasso is because he made one painting. We know because he made millions of paintings, right? So I think that just, like, doing sheer quantity is really helpful for a young person. It's just do a lot of testings, make a bunch of small bowls, make a sculpture of a small head and take a press mold off it, and press that head and make 25 little test press molds, and glaze those up. I think quantity is a good tip.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I'm resonating on your idea that really clay and art is a journey into ourselves, right? That you were talking about how you find yourself and you find what's important to you. And in lots of ways, art really pushes us to do that. We can sort of get by in life doing other kind of work, but when we get into art and maybe paint, I'm not a painter, so I don't know, that might be the same thing. But really, it is still about finding yourself, isn't it?
I think it is. Because it's we I feel like I don't even know what I'm doing until I look backwards and I say, "Oh, interesting." Like you sort of reveal yourself to yourself.
Yes. That's a lovely way of saying that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, I really appreciate you spending this time with us today. It's been fantastic talking with you, and I've enjoyed many of your ideas. Is there any? We've talked a little bit about ideas you might have for emerging artists, or maybe old artists who are starting something new. Is there anything that we've missed? Is there a nugget of advice that you have for people around what they that would help them move in their practice?
I don't know if it's advice that will fit everyone, but for me, I'm really open to learning. And I think this, if we keep ourselves open to learning, not in especially as clay artists, I think sometimes we put ourselves in a little box, like we're only clay artists, and so we only look at clay. Like if you open yourself up to looking at other types of media and even expressing yourself through other types of media. We talked a lot about creating surface on sculptures, but what better way to practice mark making than on paper or on sand at the beach? Or, like different tools are going to make different marks, and sort of keeping ourselves open to experimentation. I started doing a lot of collage lately, the last couple of years, just cutting paper and putting marks on paper and cutting that and sort of like allowing myself that freedom to experiment. I think that the sort of like the older that we get, we become less playful. And I think it's really important to keep that sense of play and experimentation. And like I mentioned before, everything doesn't have to be a masterpiece. It might end up in the circular file at the end of the day, but sort of keeping ourselves open to that sense of playfulness is, I think, really important for artists to do.
Yeah, like you've talked about joy. Like it's really important to connect with your joy. What is it about that piece or a part of that piece that really brings you joy? How can I practice and practice lots, make lots of things, right? And to work outside the box. Don't just stay limited to a certain kind of clay or a certain temperature or a certain mark making or, whatever. It's about playing and experimenting and having fun and connecting with yourself.
Yeah, I like your encapsulation. It sounds like fun. Sign
Wow.
me up.
Yeah. Absolutely. Sign me up to your class. I'm coming down to San Jose. Excellent. That's great. Hey, thanks so much for spending some time with me and our audience here today. I really appreciate it.
It has been such a pleasure and so much fun talking to you. Thank you for inviting me, Bob.
You're most
It's an
welcome.
honor. Thank you.
We'll talk again. Thank you.
All right, great.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.